All right, last Sunday I introduced the subject matter of life world. Every one of us has one, at least one, probably several. A life world is the socially constructed, socially interpreted universe that we're born into. We're not simply born into the environment of Earth. We're born into a socially constructed universe. It's socially constructed by generations before us. This life world is taught to us by our parents and other teachers, or in other means in which it comes to us. Jesus was born. That's the intention of Luke in his material in chapters 1 and 2. Jesus was born. He was conceived. He was delivered. And he was, as Martin Heidegger, the philosopher, says, he was thrown into the world. Now, what is interesting, if you will, go to Luke 2:1. We're so used to hearing this story during Advent and on Christmas Eve that we just kind of go right past this part. In those days, a decree went out from Emperor Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration and was taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And all went to their own towns to be registered. What Luke is telling you is that Jesus was born into the Roman life world. It was the Roman Empire. He's not just giving you a little bit of historical trivia for you history buffs. The rest of you don't have to pay any attention to it. He's telling you that Jesus was born into the Roman life world. But, right as soon as he says that, you're now into the Jewish life world. Let's continue. Joseph also went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea to the city of David called Bethlehem because he was descended from the house and family of David. All of a sudden, you're in the Jewish life world. The broader setting, not only historically, not only in terms of the empire, but the broader setting is the Roman government. Its power, its authority. But Jesus is not influenced greatly at all by the Roman Empire. Paul will be. Paul is born into three life worlds. He's born into the Roman life world. He's born into the Jewish life world, that being his primary life world, though heavily influenced in the Roman and Greek world. And then the pagan world. And so he's born into multiple life worlds. Jesus primarily is in the Jewish life world. And what you're finding in Luke is material information on this life world. Now, you've got it all through the Old Testament. And all of that is assumed here when you start talking about Bethlehem, the house of David, there'll be a Messiah. You got to be in that life world to know what in the world. You hear that? What in the world you're talking about? You've got to be in that life world. Now, last week I showed you in this story, starting in verse 21. We always stop at 20. Christmas is over and we move on. But we're continuing. In 21, after 8 days had passed, it was time to circumcise the child. When a woman gave birth to a son, she was unclean and had to wait 7 days before doing anything ritually, and like for example the circumcision, but had to wait 33 days before presenting herself to the temple or some priestly figure in order to be declared unclean. Now for a daughter, she would have twice as long a period of time. So it would be 66 days that she was considered unclean before she could be ritually entered back into the religion and its practice. Now, that's all part of the life world. And I tried to point out that that's what Luke is talking about. Circumcision, the naming of Jesus on that eighth day, that's all part of the life world of Judaism in which Jesus is raised. What it's saying is he's born into his parents' arms and immediately into the history of his people. Immediately into the faith of his people. Immediately into their traditions and their customs and practices, all their beliefs and all that. He's in the life world. It's, you know, it's like saying his parents are embracing him and his life world is too. He is thrown into it. He did not have a choice in the womb. They didn't send it like they do when you're in the hospital and you got this little menu list. What would you like to have for breakfast tomorrow morning? It's not that. You know, would you like to enter into the Jewish life world? Or would you like to enter some other? Would you like to have Mary and Joseph's parents? Would you like somebody else? You don't have a choice. You are thrown into the world into which you are born. And that's the way I'm describing what Luke is getting at here. Now, the next step is that he is presented, and this is after 33 days. He's taken to the temple in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is, of course, part of that life world, the very center of it. He's taken there for a presentation, and this isn't just, I present my child to the Lord. It was said that the firstborn, whether children, and it has to be male, firstborn male or animals, firstborn male animal, belongs to the Lord. And you come and bring and make that presentation. So it's a purification for Mary, and it's a presentation of Jesus as the firstborn male. That's all part of the Jewish life world. You're in it now. And for us who are not in that life world, we have to go back and immerse ourselves in it and learn it if we're going to understand anything that's going on here. We don't live in that world. I told you last week, it's like when I went to Clemson, I met for the very first time in my life guys who were not from my life world. They were from New Jersey. And I did not know what that was. And Margie and has always laughed when I've told this story, but when I went to seminary, I had never had a bagel. It wasn't part of my life world. I thought it was a stale donut that the professor was serving us. I truly did. I couldn't figure out why they were spreading stuff on it. And then later I found out what a bagel is. It's a very simple little thing, but it just wasn't part of my life world. And I understand for others, grits would not be part of their life world. And Beth went to Chicago and asked for biscuit. And they said, ma'am, we don't have biscuits here in Chicago that we just serve straight out like this. So, different world. And you and I live in so many different worlds, we're not even aware of it. And because we're multicultural, we're multi-world. And there's still many more worlds that we could be part of. Jesus has one major life world and one only, and that is Judaism. Now, what I talked about last week is that the life world of religion, and this is the case with all life worlds, but particularly with religions, externally appears, visibly, materially appears as culture. Culture is the outward expression. So that's where you encounter a life world, is in the culture. And that culture of religion is around literature or scriptures, objects, places, and practices. So here's a place. First of all, it was Bethlehem. Then it's Jerusalem. A place. It's the temple. Objects, practices, circumcision, naming, presentation, purification. That's culture. That's the outward expression of a life world. And that's how we encounter it. However, a life world is more than a culture. It's more than a social environment. It is a symbolic universe. It's a worldview. It's pre-constructed. So in other words, when you're born into this life world, those who teach you about it teach you not only the practices and the customs and the objects and whatever, but they teach you how to put it all together. There's a pre-construction. There's a framework. I call that the hermeneutical framework. Hermeneutical means interpretive. And so we're all given this framework, a basic interpretation. This is what's what. And if we don't have that, we can't function. We can't survive. And by the way, no infant is born with it. An infant only has random stimuli of light and sound. Makes no sense whatsoever. None whatsoever. And what we do is we start telling this infant what's what. We start giving them an interpretive framework, a hermeneutical framework. And if you don't do that, then they can't function. They can't survive. They can't make it. And that's one of the That's probably the richest and greatest gift you can give to your child, is this hermeneutical framework. Of course, parents never think about what framework it is they're giving to their children, but they give them one. And then when they go to school, they begin to be exposed to other frameworks and or variations of their own framework. When they go to college, particularly if they go away to college or move out of a life world that has been their own, you know, for example, don't go to a Christian college or something. Well, even if you do that, you're in another life world. That kind of thing. So Jesus has given not only a culture, but he's given this hermeneutical framework. And I said last week that it is revealed or shown up in Simeon in the temple. If you go to verse 29, Master, now you're dismissing your servant. That word servant is a part of the hermeneutical framework. You're dismissing your servant in peace. Peace is a word, is a concept in that hermeneutical framework. You didn't know that, because you're not in that hermeneutical framework unless you have learned servant peace. You know, when Paul says he is our peace, he's broken down the dividing wall between the groups, we don't know what in the world that's about unless we enter that framework and learn it. The same thing with the word servant. You don't understand until you enter that life world. Get that framework put together the way this is put together. Simeon says, my eyes have seen your salvation. What's salvation? It's in that hermeneutical framework. It is key to it. Very key to it. And my question always is, when we use the same terms, do we even have anything close to what it was in the biblical hermeneutical framework, such as salvation? What is salvation that we've been taught and raised in? Maybe it's a completely different hermeneutical framework than even the Scriptures and Judaism in which Jesus was born. I think it is. I think what we talk of as salvation is something completely different. But see, we don't know it because we're using the same word. It's like the word love. You know, we use the word love, it doesn't mean the same thing. And so when you're reading the word love in the Bible, you read it through your hermeneutical framework. You're reading it as something other than what it is in the text. So in other words, you've got to go back and you've got to learn the life world. You've got to learn, not just the culture, you've got to learn that, but you've got to learn the hermeneutical framework, which is the most important thing. And then he says, a light of revelation to the Gentiles. Revelation is a key part of the hermeneutical framework. The glory of your people Israel. Man, that is just hermeneutical framework language all over the place that Simeon is using. And Anna, the old lady who never leaves the temple, is the same way, as I described last week. She's talking to everybody that she can about this child, and to all who were looking, this is verse 38, to all who were looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. And Simeon, back in, what's the verse? Verse 25. Was looking for the consolation of Israel. To us, that means nothing. Looking for the redemption of Jerusalem, looking for the consolation of Israel. That didn't ring a bell with us at all. It just goes over. And I'm just telling you, that is key to this hermeneutical framework, and you better learn that piece. These things start clicking after a while, and you start picking it up and going, wait a minute, that means something. That wouldn't ordinarily mean anything to me as a Baptist down in Virginia in the 21st century. Because that's not my life world. That's not my hermeneutical framework. And the objective here is to enter into the hermeneutical framework of the Scriptures. And thus, of Jesus and the people that were his ancestors and the people of the early church. All right. Any questions about that?
Are you going to tell us what the hermeneutical framework is of consolation?
Of consolation?
Yeah.
Well, you go back to Isaiah, and there's a passage where he talks about comfort, comfort my people. You know, there's a song or during Advent, whatever. It's the idea that there will come the time, eschatologically, when God will send the one who will be the comforter for Israel. He will send the Messiah. Israel, who has been rebellious and resistant, will be judged and then we'll be comforted. In other words, that's the mercy of God. It's a twofold mercy. So see how it begins to open up this story? It begins to open up this. They're talking about the salvation when everything is restored on Mount Zion, on Jerusalem. So you go back to the prophets and you read about the restoration and what's supposed to happen on Jerusalem. And if you go to the book of Revelation, you've got a new Jerusalem coming and God dwells in Jerusalem and there's not even a temple anymore. And again, it's all building on the same picture of the world, the same pre-constructed universe. And all I'm pointing out is just for you to become very, very much aware that what you're reading is the religious culture, but in and at the heart of that culture is this framework of beliefs. These are framing beliefs. It's like, and they use this all the time, it's like a house. Israel was called the house of the Lord, right? And the temple was the house. The idea was that this is where God dwells, in this house of Israel, this house of the temple. What's important is this house have the foundation of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the prophets, and so forth. And as Paul would say, have the cornerstone is Jesus Christ, and then the foundation of the apostles. That is extremely important. That's your hermeneutical framework that's underneath you. And then the superstructure, you know, we're talking about what's behind these walls, the framework, the 2x4s and all that's going on, framing this house. You know, you ever talk about going to frame a house? That's what they're talking about. That's how I'm using it. At the heart of Judaism is not just these practices and customs and rituals. There's a heart that's deeper. It's beneath them. And it's the superstructure for everything and for everything hanging on it. These are load-bearing beliefs. And they fit together in this structure. And so, by the way, so does Christianity. But what happens is we don't know the structure. And the structure, without us realizing, has turned into something else. And so it is like what Jesus says in Matthew 7. You build a house and you discover that one day it looked like the same house, but it really wasn't because it didn't have the same foundation. It didn't have the same superstructure. It didn't have the framing. It was something else.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about the Old Testament in Isaiah and where they were when that was written, covered by people, and the complexity of them expecting the kind of consolation that the prophets and the restoration back then intended, and living within a society that was occupied by Romans.
Right.
So
right.
The consolation could be interpreted differently depending upon who you were talking with at the time. But it looks like for Simeon, that consolation is the Old Testament consolation.
Right.
The deep enriching of the peacemaking within the Jewish culture.
Right.
Of course, you had lots of people who would walk around in the temple in that day and see this infant and go, well, even if that is, we have to train him in war because we have to overcome the Roman Empire.
Right, right.
Now we have Luke interpreting the consolation within who Jesus was and what that meant then.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. There's competition in the hermeneutical framework of Judaism.
Yes.
You know, with the Maccabean revolt and with the Zealots, you've got this revolutionary idea that you're talking about. And that will then produce consolation. And there are others who are going, no, it is the Messiah who comes and he will be the consolation or the salvation, the redemption of Jerusalem and of Israel and of all the nations. He will be the light of the glory of God.
That opens up a whole new discussion about how we now interpret the consolation of the world or the redemption of the world through Christ risen.
Right. What I'm suggesting is, very strongly, is that what we must do is we must go back into the biblical theological framework and start there. Learn it to know what our faith is, and then we begin to enlarge that and understand that framework and live by that framework in the kind of environment we live in. They kind of work together, but the primary emphasis is on the framework, learning this framework. All right, let's move to the story, and that's a good segue into the story today. We're going to continue. Jesus goes with his parents every year to Jerusalem for the Passover. There's that culture, that life world culture, right? Jerusalem, annual festivals. By the way, there were three festivals. The biggest one was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, or it was called Passover. And you remember Jesus was observing Passover when he gave what's now called the Lord's Supper to those who were disciples. That's what was going on in Jerusalem when he was crucified, Passover. And he became the Passover lamb and on and on. But you're in this Jewish cultural setting. And so Jesus, and this is in verse 41, every year went with his parents to the festival of the Passover. He was 12 years old and somehow got separated from them and his parents, and they traveled in groups, you know, families and relatives and friends all traveled together, and you can imagine that there was some kind of mix-up, and they realized when they were one day out that Jesus wasn't with them. So they went back to Jerusalem looking for him, and I'm sure like you do when you lose something along the way, you look on the side of the road all the way back, you know, just in case you lost it somewhere in traveling. But they make it all the way back to Jerusalem and look around, and they go to the temple, assuming that he was in the group of travelers, they did not find him. When they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem to search for him, and after 3 days they found him in the temple sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Luke portrays Jesus as a student. He is not the teacher. Although in the next verse, all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. The teachers were amazed at their students' understanding. He was a 12-year-old. And by this point in Jewish thinking, you are supposed to be coming of age. You know, think about in our life world what coming of age is. Now, it used to be 18. You know, when you became 18, you were of age. That was it. You could smoke and drink and vote and go to the military and whatever. And we still have some of that. But we bump some other things up to 21, and we bump one or two things down to 16, such as driving. Used to be you could marry earlier, like 16. Now they bump that up, you know, to 18 without parents' permission and so on. So just think about when is coming of age for us. We're in that 18 to 21 range, usually somewhere in that. But we also begin to realize that the generations today really have not come of age until, what, I don't know, 28, 30, something like that. Maybe it's after they leave your house, after they've been out and come back to get started and get set up and whatever. That's becoming a cultural pattern for us. We've had it happen to us, and many of you have got it happening to you right now. And it's just interesting that you've got these kind of patterns. Well, at 12 years old, they were expected. By the way, you know, Mary and Joseph might have been 12, 13, 14-year-olds. There's great likelihood, because that's when you got married. Think about it, your life expectancy wasn't very long. And, you know, you move on. Whereas with us, the longer we stretch out this life expectancy, we don't realize that we stretch out the coming of age. And we also stretch out the time you get married. You know, now young people are getting married in their 30s. You know, it's not because they're just desperate. You know, they finally just land somebody in their 30s. It's just they got other things they're setting up and other things they're doing. Besides, they got a whole lifespan. And it used to be when you're retired, you just, well, that's it. I got the gold watch, and now I'll just get ready for the casket. I mean, that was the kind of the idea, wasn't it? And you better go take a trip before that happens. Not anymore. All the stories now are you've got 30 years maybe, so stretch, you know, out the retirement funds and make sure you got something to do, and you know, you want to be productive and all of this kind of thing. It's a whole different world, whole different life world. So our assumptions, our framework begins to change. Well, anyway, at 12 years old, Jesus is coming of age, Luke is saying. If you notice in in verse 40 and in verse 52. 40 and 52. He's talking about the growth of this boy. He's growing in stature. He's growing in age. He's growing in wisdom. And that's the point of this story. Jesus is a student of these teachers. He's learning, and let me put it this way, he's learning the hermeneutical framework and as well as the culture of his people. He's learning his life world. And he's learning it, obviously, very well. That's the point of Luke's telling this story. He's asking them questions, and I wonder what kind of questions, and typically the questions that a student would ask the teacher in that life world were questions about, remember the four things I mentioned, the scriptures, the objects, the places, and the practices. Now tell me, what am I supposed to do to keep the Sabbath? You know, give me the practice I'm supposed to do or not do. When do I wash my hands? Or what kind of, you know, those things he had to learn as part of his cultural life world. I don't think that's what Jesus was asking, because I don't think that would have amazed them. I don't think they would have been amazed at his understanding that he got it all figured out about the utensils you're supposed to use at the meal and what kind of animal you're supposed to get for the side. I don't think they're impressed by it. I think what they're impressed by is this guy is, and I have no reason to say this other than just this fact that they're amazed. I just got a feeling Jesus is digging into this foundation and this superstructure of the faith of Israel. Because that's the way he taught. He didn't teach on the level of the culture. In fact, he broke a lot of the cultural rules. Like, you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath, but they considered picking some wheat grains and eating them as a work. And Jesus and his disciples did that. You're not supposed to go eat with sinners. And Jesus' disciples did that. They weren't trying to prove a point and push some kind of social agenda. They were just simply not as focused on the cultural practices and objects and places. Though they were, what they were more interested in is that foundation and the superstructure, what I'm calling the hermeneutical framework. I think Jesus was asking hermeneutical framework questions. And when I see the Lord face to face one day, I want to ask Him, is that what you were asking in the temple? Because that would amaze them. Who asks those kinds of questions? Who deals with that kind of stuff? And that's what the teachers supposedly were to deal with. And let me just say one more thing. Remember when Nicodemus came to Jesus in John chapter 3 and Jesus pointed out he was a teacher of Israel? But this guy didn't even understand what Jesus was talking about. It's that kind of situation. Here he is at 12 years old. Now, it's not because he's got this super knowledge. He's a human being. He's not a supernatural figure. In Luke's gospel, Jesus is a boy who's growing up. He's growing in stature and wisdom and so forth. But he is focused on the foundational, the founding matters. And that is astounding. And the way he puts those things together. Is, I think, what is being focused on. And so with Nicodemus, he's saying, you know, you must be born of the Spirit in order to enter the kingdom. And Nicodemus is saying, you mean come back in my mother's womb? He's on the level of the practice. You know, the OBGYN practice. And Jesus says, no. You're a teacher of Israel and you don't understand this? This is basic stuff. So what I'm saying is, he went underneath and went behind the walls into the hermeneutical framework. And I think that's out of which he taught as well.
So you don't think he being God, even at age 12, has got knowledge that the rest of them don't have?
No.
Socratic methodology type question.
No. We've been told that from the time we were growing up in Baptist Sunday school, but it's false. No. Remember his disciples asked him in the opening of the book of Acts, tell us when this is going to happen or whatever, and he says, I don't know. What did he say? The Father knows.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and then he says in John's Gospel, which is the highest Christology, he always says, he's not talking to himself, he's talking to the Father. Always in John's Gospel. And he says, the words that I speak have been given to me. or the works that I do have been given to me. And if you've heard these words, you've heard God, if you've seen these works. That does not mean that He in of Himself is omniscient, omnipresent, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
But we
create it that way, which I think is a false hermeneutical framework for interpreting Jesus as the Christ.
But He does seem
to be. I mean, you see what I'm saying is, You create another framework, and then you look at Jesus with it, rather than the one at which Luke and the other gospel writers are looking at Jesus.
But He does seem to be more mature for His age, though, at a minimum, in terms of what, I mean, that's how He's able to amaze these.
I think He's more. I think the idea is there is something exceptional here. I don't think it's the knowledge. I don't think it's even that. He's got the grasp of an 80-year-old person, you know, who's been like a scholar. We're reading into it. I think what he's saying is, here is someone who's exceptional because he's actually staying in the temple and he's interested in these things. What 12-year-old or what adult is interested in that? 12 o'clock comes, we're gone. We don't hang around for 3 or 4 more days. I mean, you sort of begin to frame it that way. And I think you better. The point is, Jesus is a student, and He's a good student. He's applying Himself. It's like all faculty know at the university level as well as high school. You got one or two kids in the room who really are engaged, who really are entering the world that you're teaching. Rest of them couldn't care less. They're there for the credit. They're there for the boy or girl who's sitting across the room, or you know. And that's not to say they're not totally disinterested. I mean, they have some interest, but they're not really entering the world of chemistry or the, you know, I didn't. There are a lot of worlds I didn't enter. And I'm sure my math professors were all disappointed that I wasn't one of those. But when you come to this, He's the one who's hanging back, you know, and who is involved in this. He's immersed in it. I think that's the point of Luke's gospel.
Well, God is revealing Himself through Jesus because He's saying that He's giving these words through.
Well, that's later. Don't read that into this story.
Oh, okay.
Just let Jesus be a boy.
Okay.
That's the issue, Edwin. I think we're learning we're getting a correction of our hermeneutical framework right here.
Right.
When did Jesus become God? If that's the case. And was He God?
And see, I wouldn't frame it that way.
Yeah, or was He Son of God? In John's figure, the only begotten Son of God.
But to understand Son of God, you've got to go back into the biblical theological framework to understand Son of God. Or even understand God, you've got to go back into that and start framing it this way. We use the language, but maybe not frame it the way that the language was framed in the biblical material. And so what it basically comes down to is, that's why you and I must be students. That's why you and I must be learners. And really apply ourselves like Jesus here in the temple, if I can put it that way. We're not in a temple like the temple in Jerusalem, but we do still have this need to enter not only the religious culture, and you can learn that up one side and down the other, and never understand or get at the framework of that culture. And so then the culture can change and become something else, and the framework is again something else. So it's not even the same house, although it's called the same house. And that's my criticism of so much going on in Christianity, that it becomes something else, framed much more in line with modern secular framework than a biblical theological framework. We're using some of the same terms, so we think we're speaking the same language and the same framework, but we're not. All right, let me move on with this story. This is an interesting one. You remember, remember Jesus in Matthew's Sermon on the Mount? Jesus says to seek first the kingdom. I want to take you to verse 49. Jesus says, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" The house would be the temple. The house would be Israel. "Didn't you know that I would be in my Father's house?" The better translation of that is, I must be about my Father's interest. Now, the term servant, for example, the servant is one in the house, and so the servant must be in the house, because the servant is the servant of that house, and of the owner of the house. Jesus used that parable, all that set up all the time. But the servant has the responsibility to be about the owner's interest, the owner's business in that house. So that's what Jesus is saying. I'm here about the interest or business of my Father in this house of Israel, this house of the temple. Now let me go back to the Sermon on the Mount with that "seek you first the kingdom." The kingdom would be the interest of God. Do you know where that "seek first the kingdom" statement is placed on the Sermon on the Mount? Do you know what the context is? Do you remember? Jesus' teaching context. Do not worry what you are to eat and to drink and so forth. Look at the birds of the air and the lilies of the field. Seek first the kingdom of God and all else will be added to you. All right. In that context, what are people interested in? What are they focused on? What's their business? Food and drink. Well, that's important stuff. You want to eat, you want to be clothed. That's important stuff. However, seek first, not the interest of food and drink, seek first the interest of this house. And so I would then say again, I don't think Jesus is asking them questions about ritualistic food and drink. I think he's asking them questions about this house, what it's for, its interest. What are the interests? What are the founding, believing framework, the load-bearing frameworks? I think he's asking them the deep questions, the deepest questions. Now you think about this. A child growing up in our culture gets into the teen years and begins to start questioning. Not just questioning the life world into which he or she's been thrown, but begins to question, asking the questions, the big questions that this life world is supposed to answer. Not all children do this, but this is kind of a rite of passage where you begin to develop your ability to think and to struggle with these kinds of things, and you begin to ask the deep questions. And that's one of the values of going to a university or college and getting away, is that you get to sit up and stay up all night asking each other those questions. You don't necessarily know what, you call them bull sessions, at least not what we called them in my day. I don't know what you call them today, but we just stayed up all night, and you know, about 3 or 4 in the morning you begin to say, what's this all about? What's going on? Why are we here? The greatest question that a philosopher can possibly ask and try to answer is, why is there something and not nothing? Why? Remember, a child starts asking, why? You say, because. Why? Why this? Why that? But it's the basic question of why. Another deep question, who am I? Who are we? Another question, I can keep, I sat down and I came up with 30 just like that. Why am I here? Why are we here? Where am I? I don't mean just geography. I mean, where? In terms of life, in terms of history, you know, where am I? Or what time is this? Am I of any significance or value? Does anyone care about me and love me? What am I to believe? How should I live? What's the point of living? What is important, essential for life, and what's not? Seek ye first the kingdom. That's important. That's essential. Who or whom do I serve? I'm a servant of... Well, most young people don't yet realize that they're a servant of somebody or something. But who is it? What is it? To what will I give and sacrifice my life? To what will I give and sacrifice my children? Martin Luther said, faith is what you're willing to give your children to. You sacrifice them to it. Is this all there is? Is there anything more to what's going on? What's really going on? And I could just keep going. This is not just a checklist of questions that we come up with that are reserved for the classroom. These are just human questions. When you begin to say, okay, now I've come of age and I'm looking at the life world and you're digging into the hermeneutical framework of it that I've been raised in. Now, I'm about to go on. Do I continue living in this life world? Do I change it? Do I modify it? Do I add to it? What do I do with it? Now, there are some who just never, they just keep right on going and keep the same life world and the same hermeneutical framework. Never changes. But there's a big coming of age matter of struggling with these kinds of things and asking these kinds of questions. Now, what usually happens for us in our culture is that by the time we finish college or military or whatever, in those earliest years, we already are into the culture of food and drink. We got to pay the bills. It's everyday matters. And now you may be married, you may have children, you've got to pay taxes, you've got to, you know, perform at the job, you've got to meet job performance requirements. You mean, all of a sudden, we're into the culture of our life world. It's like this boat we're in, and this stream is just taking us rapid fire down this stream. Next thing you know, 30 years have passed, 40 years have passed. And then you would go, wait a minute. What's this all about? What was this? And those questions continue to bubble back up. You have answered them. Or you've taken somebody else's answers for them. But you begin to raise these kinds of questions about what is undergirding everything and what is framing everything. And that's when people have these crises. We call it a midlife crisis or some other kind of crisis. You know, or you go off the track. You know, or you self-destruct. You're really coming all the way down, shaking everything to the foundations. If there's any foundation really there, other than just shifting sand. And so you think about how important these questions are. And I think what Jesus is doing in his adult ministry is going into an adult population that only knows this one life world, this one religious culture, this one hermeneutical framework. But by that point, don't even know the framework or have forsaken it and don't know that they've forsaken it. You know, it's all in all with this kind of apostasy, this kind of unfaithfulness is characteristic of Israel. And so when Jesus comes in, I think Jesus raises those questions again. And I think he pushes forth the hermeneutical framework to frame all the responses to those questions again. And I think he's in keeping with what he learned. I think he's in keeping with the Torah and the prophets. He's in keeping with what is the true faith of Israel. And they don't recognize it. And they can't figure out where he got this. And they can't figure out how it is that he teaches with such authority. But he's not teaching what the rabbis are teaching. Wait a minute. Is this even truth? Who is this man? You know, what Jesus is teaching is what they should have learned in their life world. And I think he's raising these very basic questions. And he answers them with the kingdom of God. And the kingdom of God is a world. It's a life world. And that's what he's offering to them. And you enter that life world and you learn it. I think that's the best way I can put it. Now, our problem is that we take a life world, we take a religious culture, and we take a hermeneutical framework, and we live with it for 30, 40, 60 years, and it never changes. Would you wear a pair of eyeglasses that you had when you were in freshman year of high school? Would you still be wearing that? Not just designer problems, but lens problems. No. Your glasses have to grow up with you. Your glasses have to change. So many people have an 8-year-old faith. The faith of an 8-year-old. Or they have the faith of a 16-year-old. Because that's where they got it locked in, and they decided, that's enough, I know all I need to know, that's it, period. And then they try to run by that, for the rest of their lives. And that's a common pattern in our Christian life world, our Christian culture. And I think it was very similar in Israel. And I think what Jesus is doing is stepping in with a grown-up understanding, which was developing early on, continued to develop. By the way, Jesus was around 30 when he began his public ministry. So after this incident, which is the only childhood incident we have of Jesus, 18 years have passed. And so a lot more seasoning, a lot more wisdom forming. And I think when he steps in and starts preaching the gospel, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom of God, which is what he did, I just think they're not prepared for it. They've got some things in place, but there's so much that they do not have in place that by this point they should have in place. And yet Jesus has to do this remedial stuff, and then they reject even that. And then, of course, in the book of Hebrews, it's interesting because he says, by now you should all be teachers, but you're still on mother's milk. And you're still on the pablum of formula. In other words, you're just still back where you started. You didn't grow. And I think that's why it's so important that twice in the second chapter of Luke's Gospel, he says, and Jesus grew. And he grew not only in age and stature, he grew in wisdom. And wisdom is not he got smarter. Wisdom is a term in the hermeneutical framework of Israel. And it has to do with the wisdom of God. It has to do with the wisdom of understanding these things. Knowing these things, understanding them, and living by them. And he's growing in that. And then when he presents it, he's asking them to enter the life world of the kingdom of God and grow in that understanding. Live in that. All right, let me pause and see if you have a question or some response.
I've got one.
Yeah.
What age do you think he realized he was the Son of God? By 12?
You know, what is interesting is that you do not have any statement where Jesus refers to himself that way. Or even the term Son of Man. He almost speaks in third person. So I don't know how to answer your question. And also, I think Jesus understood early on, and I would say even by this point, I think Jesus understood that all of Israel is the Son of God. And I go back to Exodus. I don't know if you ever remember this, but when Moses goes to Pharaoh to tell Pharaoh that God wants this people, the statement he makes is, "Let my son go." And so Israel is viewed as the son. But Israel is the disobedient son. Jesus is the son who is obedient to the will of the Father. And so I would say he's growing up in that sonship that Israel has failed to grow up in. And he is the one who is fulfilling the will of God. And so I'm going to say early on, but I can't tell you exactly.
I would think at least by 12. But
yeah, I mean, I don't think he's seeing himself in a role except the role of doing the will of the Father. In other words, like seek the first kingdom. He's seeking the interest of the Father. When Israel, the other son, is not seeking that interest. They are very religious. See, there's a huge difference between being religious and being faithful, or you know, to this relationship of the will of God. That help? I mean, I don't know. There's any specific answer
that's
to
not
it?
The point.
Right.
There is something interesting about his words. Whether you interpret the RSV exactly with that statement, "My Father's house or my Father's interest is my," he says, not "our." That is interesting. It doesn't mean he understands himself to be the Son of God as we understand it to be post-resurrection. But I think you see these early pieces that suggest a little bit like the tendrils on the roots of a tree. There's something going on. That's all.
All right, and I'm glad you brought that up. Let me show you something. Of course, we hear you say that, and we read this in a culture of individualism, radical individualism. So then we go, then Jesus is just taking himself off with God into this very special relationship. You know, you don't. But you're exactly right. There is this sense of that's expressed in this word my as I'm related to Father God. Because I'm part of this people. They had a social understanding. So it would start out with our Father. And Jesus taught his disciples to pray that way. But in that our, O-U-R, is M-Y, is my. But see, again, I've just reframed it, trying to get us away from our radical individualism, which would not have matched their hermeneutical framework.
And later on in John, you hear, according to John, Jesus saying, I and the Father are one. Now, that's a different kind of stage of his understanding of things.
But to take the word one, what does one mean? There are different kinds of unity.
Okay, sure. They accused him, of course, as making himself equal to God. So their understanding was, you don't talk about yourself that way.
But they're wrong in that in the history of Israel, there were always those like Moses and Elijah who stood in that place of the prophet or the priest or whatever, and who had a unity with the Father in terms of function. You know. And so they should have understood Jesus in that role. In other words, they should have understood Jesus. For example, even when they had forgiveness, and they said, only God can forgive. Now, all the way through history of Israel. Don't you know your own history? Don't you know your own faith? Forgiveness has been a part of the life of Israel because God has forgiven Israel. Then that power of forgiveness is given to them, and they exercise it as the priest of God, the priestly people. But when you lose that, then you look at Jesus saying, I forgive the sin, or, you know, go and sin no more, or something like that. And they go, what are you doing? What are you doing? And yet they've got a long history that's their own history, and it's framed in such a way that they don't even know it. So no wonder they think that he's taken the place of God. He's stepped in and taken over, and he's blasphemous and on and on.
Well, didn't God, in Exodus, God adopted them. So he is their father. He adopted them as his people.
Right.
So
right,
that might just mean that all of the Jews should be their
part. Right. And then Paul takes that language in Romans 8 and uses it. We have been adopted.
Yeah.
And then but as soon as he says adoption, he goes into this, and now the whole creation is groaning in travail, waiting for the revealing of the sons and daughters of God. Well, you know, that's interesting. You know, we're adopted in the family. Jesus is our older brother kind of image. That wouldn't have been foreign to that framework. And we are being revealed to be the sons and daughters of God. That kind of language is very common across that. And so if I say that I'm the son of God, I don't, and I mean it in that framework, that doesn't mean what you might hear that to mean. Right? So
you're not saying that I and the Father are the same. He's saying I and the Father are united, is the way I would
be. Yes. You never hear, even in John's Gospel, which is the highest Christological Gospel there is, the language is way up there, very close between the Father and Son. It is always the Father and the Son. And you do not have a connection or sort of sameness. In other words, Jesus wasn't praying to himself. We did not kill God on the cross. We killed God's Son, or we killed God's prophet, God's Messiah, God's priest. And I can just keep rolling out the language. We killed the revelation of God. We killed the salvation of God in and through this one. In other words, the fullness of God was pleased to dwell in him. That shouldn't shock any good Jew. It doesn't mean that God took himself and stuffed it into a human body. What it means is the fullness of the glory of God, the fullness of the truth of God, the fullness of the righteousness of God dwelled in him. That's what it says. Same thing for the church. The fullness of God is to dwell in the body. The truth of God is to dwell in and through us. But that is not a unity or identification of sameness. It is a unity of relationship and shared function or shared mission. Again, Jesus says, I'm about the business of my Father. I'm about the interest of my Father. I'm about the concerns of the kingdom. It's just tied together. Which, of course, against Israel, who's not interested, and yet they're in this house. There is a contrast that is immediately set up by the story.
It seems to me that his young life is one of teaching himself and being willing to be taught by others to be humble and a servant and receptive to God's will, so that by the time God calls him out for his ministry, he is receptive and is willing to go and responsive to the call.
Yeah, now you're beginning to move in the right track, which is he must be taught or else he has nothing to teach. Like, you can't teach chemistry unless you first have been taught chemistry. And also, the chemistry professor is the one who continues being a student of chemistry, if he's a good professor. But you know that you've not had good ones who didn't continue to be students of their own discipline. So if you're not a student of your own discipline, why would I be? And why would I listen to you when you don't know anything much more? Like, you know, a TA or graduate assistant, you know, you begin to get a little ticked there because you're paying big bucks, or your parents are paying big bucks, or you're taking out a loan for somebody who doesn't know a whole lot more than you do. In other words, what I'm saying is Jesus is learning, but he's learning more than just what the rabbis even have, because he's getting underneath, which is what they should be doing. He gets underneath to the foundations and the framing beliefs that are load-bearing. I think that's what he's doing. And then later, he will clash with these teachers. Not because he's teaching something different. It's because he's teaching what they should know and should be teaching but don't know. I mean, it begins to fall into place, doesn't it? He's not teaching anything weird. He's not teaching anything exceptionally strange. He's just simply teaching what has been there in the whole history of Israel. And yet Israel has become disinterested in it. They have taken on other frameworks. They have kept a lot of these religious practices but don't have any clue what they mean. You know, it's just on and on and on that when Jesus steps in and takes what he's been taught and the wisdom that has been gained and the understanding that has been acquired, and he lays it out there, they're all in this utter disbelief. Where did you get this? Who are you? But again, when you read what he teaches over against the material of the Old Testament, you don't see that it's other than, as Matthew would say, the true interpretation of the Scriptures. He's just simply bringing it out and laying out, which they all should know. And what does he do? He takes disciples. He takes 12, which represent Israel, to teach them. In other words, Israel must be taught. And guess what? Israel refuses to be taught. In other words, Israel must put itself in the place that Jesus has been in, which is as the Son, as the one coming up to learn. That's what a son does. I think you said it well. That's what you do. And then you are prepared for the ministry that you have. You see how this works? Somebody else.
Well, the favor, it says in verse 40, he grew up in wisdom and filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. In chapter 2, verse 40, the favor of God upon him to me means that God is revealing himself through his Spirit to Jesus.
Look at it more as you would with Jesus' baptism experience. You remember what happened after he came up out of the water of baptism? There was a voice. There was the Spirit,
okay,
in the form of a dove.
Yes, you know?
And it said, the voice said, "This is my son in whom I'm well pleased." That's the favor of the Father.
Okay.
In other words, the favor of the Father is not upon Israel. Go back to what Craig was asking about. Mm-hmm. That's the disobedient one.
Right.
But the favor of the Father is upon His Son.
And that's what that... Okay.
Not just because He's my boy and, you know, I'm with my boy. But it's more of, He's the one you need to listen to. He's the one who understands. He's the one who grasps this. And what I'm trying to say is, it is not the grasp of religious culture, even though he would have that. It's the founding, the framing, the load-bearing beliefs and concepts of that house. That's what he has. In other words, you know that what the foundation is, and you know that the structure is put together in this fashion. And when you've got that, then you can understand all of the practices and the scriptures and on and on. And I think Jesus has learned that well and is now going to teach Israel, these 12 representing the 12 tribes. He's going to teach them, you must be disciples. And you're going to hear my sermon, because I'm going to preach on this morning. I'm going to say that when he says you must be as a child enter the kingdom, is you must be a student, which is what a child is. Okay.
So where would he have gotten his instructions at this point? He's at the temple, so he's coming.
Good question.
To the university. So.
You answer it. Where would he have gotten it?
Mother and father, I assume.
Mother and father.
Right.
Because think about it, they're observing not only the culture, but they're obviously teaching them the meaning of this culture. Also, their local synagogues. Even Jerusalem had synagogues. And that was the center not only of where they went to worship, but it's whether they gathered for instruction. And instruction, teaching, is at the heart of Judaism. They have a long tradition of teaching. In fact, that is at the very heart of Judaism. I mean, it's the core. This is what they did. In order to teach your children so that they can teach their children, and it will pass from generation to generation. But you write it on your forehead, you write it on your doorpost, you teach it, you teach it, you teach it. And everybody, and this was a teaching community. And what I am critical of is congregations today are not teaching communities. And therefore, we're not learning. And we've just been going for so long that, you know, we don't even, and again, we can't see why we would need to be framed as a teaching learning community. I mean, you've got to enter the life world, and you've got to enter the framework of that life world. And if you don't, you don't live in that world. You live in some other, no matter what you call it or what you think it is. I need to let you go, particularly those who are parents, to pick up your children. Hey, great discussion.
Thank you.